For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. And here we are back again at the Mount Woodgie Studios, live in Currumbin. Wow, what a guest I've got coming back for a part two. This man was a notorious bank robber. He escaped from a maximum security prison in a helicopter, and the only man to do so. His name is John Killick. He was on season one. He opened it up. He's a part of the Clink history, Stories of Redemption. John, what an honour to be sitting down with you in season three and to continue our story of the life of John Killick and the redemption story, mate. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Brent. Look, it's really a pleasure to be on the Clink, and I've watched all the programs and I think they're great. The presentation's good. The people you've had on are great, and I think everyone has shown that it's about redemption, and I would like to get that across at the start to people that may not have seen or heard any of these programs before, that most of us have been in jail, and some of us for a long time, some for a short time. But what it gets down to is not a glorification of crime, but some of us have had committed crimes that have been in the news, been in the media, and of course, that's had a lot of publicity. But I would like to say this now, that I've gone, tried really hard for redemption. And I believe, I don't talk about rehabilitation. I talk about what I believe is evolving, because the whole world works on evolving.
John, you have had such an amazing life and lived it, wow, in an exceptional way in your earlier years. To probably, you shouldn't really be here today, I'm sure. You probably think that at times. I'm sure the police back then would have liked to have aimed and shot if they could have. But you were quite evasive and far from silly. And I'd like to, for those that have gone back to season one, we got to the point, I believe, where we touched on the escape from Silverwater, the recapture and all that sort of stuff. There's so much more to John. And, John, let's talk about that next stage. So you were recaptured, you got out, but did what you did best, went back and reoffended.
I've got to say this, that there are a lot of different bank robbers. Bank robbers rob banks for various reasons. Some do it because they're just professional bank robbers and they're good at it. Some just get a kick out of it. I've read a lot of ex-bank robbers who have said that they did it for the adrenaline rush. But I did it because I needed the money. And that really was it. I never got up every morning saying, look, I'm going out there to rob a bank. I did it because I'd get in the dire straits, usually through gambling. And I knew that, you know, banks were where the money was, and that's what I did. And, I got away quite a few, but eventually when you do get caught, they really do hit you hard. The courts do hit you hard. And if you go, I just really should point out something here, that if you go through the history of bank robbers, and most of them got a history of escape, and you see most of the well-known escapes relate, you'll see that it's usually a bank robber behind it. Just look at Abbott, you know, right through Denning, all these people that escaped, Ryan and Walker, they were all bank robbers.
Bernie Matthews
was and me. And
bank robber and escapee.
And you have a look at
Russell Manser.
Russell Manser, you go with quite a few banks, had a few escapes. And you go to America, and John Dillinger escaped many times, Willie Sutton. They were famous bank robbers, they were famous escapees. So the authorities take a special interest in bank robbers, whereas if you people are like pedophiles, they get an easy run when they go into the system. And bank robbers, they always said, and the armed robbers always said, look, that they'd often get a lot bigger sentences than pedophiles did. And that's a fact. That's a fact that's gone right through. So, but I've got to say that I really should point out, that doesn't mean to say that we're saying, oh, you know, we got hit too hard. You go into a bank, you hold someone up, then some of those, there might be a few of those victims that are traumatized. And you've got to accept that. And that's why they call it a crime of violence. And I accept that, and I accept the penalty. But at the same time, when you look at it, you try to escape. And if you escape, the authorities seem to think that bank robber escapees are just about the worst criminals of all. And I do say that because you see they get the most notoriety, they get the most publicity, and they get the heavier sentences. And that doesn't mean a thing to me when I talk about redemption. I look back, I don't feel sorry for myself. I think I brag about even the system. And I should mention the date. I'm a great one on dates. Today's the 3rd of February. It was the day that Ronald Ryan was hanged, the last man hanged in Australia. It was the 3rd of February. It was 1967. And there's very good debates going on even now about that he may well have been innocent. And I was there when they hanged Ryan. And I remember they kept him in H Division right up to 6 o'clock the morning of the hanging, took him over and hanged him in D Division. And I've never seen such a volatile situation in a jail. And 7 years later to the day, 3rd of February, was the day of the Bathurst riots. And I still remember that because I think Bathurst closed for maybe 11 years over it. And the Naval Royal Commission looked in it and found that it was just a powder keg. The prisoners were a powder keg of the way people were being treated at Bathurst, and particularly Grafton and Maitland. And I'll bring this out now because the prison system's going backwards. We're not really here to talk about that, but seeing I've been and done a lot of jail, and someone who knows. And
how long have you done, John? I know, but just for our audience.
Well, I've done 30 years, which is probably 2 life sentences. In the old days, they would do about 14 years for a life. When I first went in, it was really tough. It was really tough in there, and you'd have 3 guys in a cell. They'd be in there all day, all night. I mean, they'd go in at 3 o'clock at night. The meals were atrocious. They had riots over it. You'd be locked in the yards all day. You'd write 1 letter a week, and you had to write a 1-page letter in ink, and it'd be looked at by a prison guard. If he didn't like it, he'd rip it up and make you write another one. You had no phone calls, you had no TVs, you had no radios, you had no toilet, you had no running water, you had no pyjamas, you had no sheets. And so and the lights were off at 9 o'clock. Wow. So believe me, and if you got a visit, it was a visit every 2 weeks, and it was 20 minutes through some wire mesh. It was all designed really to punish. And I saw a gradual change in the system over the years to where we got into the mid-70s where they started to bring in educational programs and in the mid-80s, the sort of televisions come in. You saw a lot of work releases, a whole heap of stuff where we actually went ahead. And the facts prove that, and the Royal Commission said it too, that there was less crime. There was less crime. But, of course, you had the heroin. That's when drugs really started too in the late 70s and early 80s. And
yeah,
there are a lot of banks. Bank robbing started going through the roof because when I first started robbing banks, there were hardly anybody. Darcy Dugan was one. Simmons, and they were both doing life. Yeah. So that wasn't a good recommendation to become a bank robber when you looked at that. But then they became... When people got into heroin and stuff like that, they raised the bar to get the money, so they started doing armed robberies.
It was something that I noticed was always, if you met a robber, most of the time, and I say this most of the time because it was only a few that I ever met that weren't, and they were on the gear, on the heroin. It was...
That's right. You came in at a time when they turned to robbing banks and it did become prolific. Crime. Once the floodgates opened, it was because of heroin and the price of heroin and stuff like that. Because when I first came into jail, there were no drugs in jail at all. There might have been a little bit of pot here and there down at Pendry's.
What was that like, John? Because I can only relate to how bad jail was with the drugs in there and. Let's not bullshit talking out of school back in there. Mate, you could buy more in jail than what you could get on the streets.
Oh, absolutely. And look, it's a different culture. Drugs, everybody knows there's so much drugs in the prison system now. Mostly ice. It destroys people. You know, I've seen people that have been on ice and it's absolutely ruined them, and inside and outside of jail. But when I first went to jail, that was tough. But it looked at everybody had a job. The sentences weren't as high. You had remissions.
That's right.
Which if you behaved yourself, you got remission. Now, look, you know, guys like me, we behave ourselves in jail, we still get knocked back for parole because we got a certain commissioner didn't want us out. So he just said, oh, it doesn't matter how good the record is. I'm opposing them getting out for this reason and that reason. And it's you can be a model prisoner for 14 years and still get knocked back for parole. In the old days, it was automatic. You got that parole if you didn't get into trouble and you got out and you got remissions for good behaviour. If you played up, you had those remissions taken off you. Now, I see guys playing up. They come into the system, they play up for 3 years. The last 3 months, they go, all right, and they say, see, we've rehabilitated him. They let him out. But the guy like me, who stays out of trouble, I'm a manipulator.
I think so, the thing is today, too, it's all about ticking the boxes, isn't it? And yes. it is a game because you know yourself, if you're doing a whack and you're down to your last 12 months, as long as you're doing all the programs and, you know, keeping your nose clean and off the out of the way of SAGRO and all the rest of it, you know, you got a pretty good chance, unless you're, you know, public interest or high profile, especially with, you know, the way that they are with under the Terrorist Act and all that sort of shit.
Well, yeah, but it's the ones that are really in the media or the ones that are high profile do have trouble getting out, you know, and I know of a certain case now, we're only talking about it today, I won't mention the name, but this particular guy's here for parole and he can't get it and they're looking for help to get him out and simply because of, it's not a horrific crime, but it's he did kill someone. It was accidental. He didn't mean to kill someone, but because of who he killed, this guy can't get out of jail. But what you're saying is right. You tick the boxes. In the old days, you tick the boxes. But in the old days, if you tick the box, you knew you'd get out. Now you're still, you have to hope to get out. Education has gone down the drain, really. You know, the art classes and all that, most of those are gone. And so much talent in jail.
I don't want to get into the whole political side of it because we both know how bad it is. But, you know, the way it is today with this ICE epidemic, the crimes that are being committed are crimes that, yeah, okay, they've been committed in the past, but not in the way that they've committed today and how they're done and how regular they've become. You know, whether it's murders, robberies, bashing of elderly, raping of children, yeah, yeah. Women. Like, it is sickening. If you went through the system now and actually looked at what crime stats are there as opposed to 30 years ago or 25 years ago, yeah, okay, it was always violent, but, like, there was more your bank robbers, your petty thieves or your car thieves, your drug dealers, what have you. There was a rapist. There was a fucking... There's always been a pedophilia fucking, you know, section of every jail. And we all know that. But today, it's just so regular. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, you see on the news, and it never happened when I was young.
No.
You'd see an old lady, 86, had been bashed and punched and, black and blue by two guys just to get a purse off her. And there's just no... You know, six people jumping in on one person. And that was the thing, what I talked about, how it was in jail in the old days before drugs and all that came in. Someone had a fight. And I had a few in jail when I was young. You have a fight, you shake hands, and later on that afternoon you're playing cards. Now, you have a fight now in jail and you beat the guy, you'll either get stabbed in the back.
100%. You can guarantee that there'll be someone sneak at you in your cell. You'll go into your slot, your door will get pulled shut, someone will sit outside and you'll get shivved. 100%. Yep. You'll be pumped.
And that's the way it is.
100%. And it'll be someone that's just been fed fucking something like a bit of bup or something just to get the job done.
Exactly right. Drugs.
100%.
We know jail's not a good place to be, and that's one of the reasons that it's good that you have podcasts like this to get it across to people. Look, we're not glorifying criminals, we're not glorifying crime, because being a criminal is no fun. Not for me.
John, just on that subject, and we're talking, and we will get away from the whole jail thing, because I think that, you know, we've touched on that in season one, and, you know, we are here to deliver the John Killick story. And a part of that story right at the moment is something very, very good that you've created with a couple of other people. It is a Facebook page. It's a community. It's a closed group that I believe is up around, but maybe quote me wrong, 8,500 to 9,000 people.
It's about 9,500.
And you have created with, as I said, a couple of other persons, and I'll allow you to make those names known if you want to, but a support group for families. Now, let's step aside from the person that's committed the crime. We get it. You fuck up, you commit the crime, you get caught, you do the time. We're all aware of that. That's just part of, that's life, yeah? But for the mums, wives, husbands, children, grandparents, there's never been a direct support network. The system will always tell you there's a hotline, you know, call welfare, put in a bluey, this and that. It's all a crock of shit. I mean, I didn't find out till days later that my wife had given birth to my son. I was sitting in Segra and they decided to tell me. And that was after days of strike that they pulled screws from the Segra section because they needed them up in the main sections. Like, there's a zero care factor. What you've been able to create, and I truly believe this is a great start to talking about your story of redemption, is providing your knowledge and others like yourself that have the ability to give people the facts and support people with trueness of what's going on in the system. Can you talk to us a bit about that, John?
Well, Brent, you're part of that group, and it's called Australian Advocate for Prisoners and Their Families. And the idea was actually Russell Mansers, a fellow bank robber who's now doing great things, as you know, with Voice of a Survivor.
The Voice of a Survivor, yep.
It was his idea, but when we started it, he asked me right at the start to come in, which I did. And
the people that you have there and a part of this group are people with genuine stories of redemption in themselves. They've all got a past. They've all educated. Like Renee, for example, is doing amazing. She's out there studying, doing some fantastic degrees. I noticed there's solicitors on there. That, you know, like it's a sensational thing you've got going.
And you look at Nick, who actually did the actual technical part of it, set it up. Nick, he was actually into drugs himself and come out of rehab. And he's just doing so great now. And the thing is that, but the greatest thing to me about the whole program is that, and I've said this a few times when I've got up and put some posts up, is that it's almost running itself. Somebody will put up a question and ask for some help. And the admin, most of the time, we don't have to answer it. We don't have to do it. We got people out there now that'll get up who know the answer and get in and help. And sometimes I'll get 20 different people saying, look, you can do this and do that. And it's very rare we get somebody asking for something that they don't get the answer to. And it, you know, we get the admin helping out too, but we don't have to answer more. When you've got people who want to do it, and that's what they're there for, that they know they're part of the group, they feel it's a sense of belonging. The group's getting bigger and better, and many of them just sent messages to me and said, "Look, I really love this group. I feel like I'm part of something for the first time." And we know, and other people said, "I wish this group had been going when I was in jail." And I tell you what, I wish it had been going when I was in jail. And a lot of us, when we go into jail for the first time, like you said, we know nothing. We know nothing about the way the system runs.
No.
We've got to learn what others tell us, because they don't tell you much when you get there.
And how's the, like I was reading the other day, John, and we won't name any names here, but because it is a closed group, in respect of those that are on there anyway, but, you know, a mum that had just lost her son, first time, there was, you know, she just felt comfortable enough to open up and ask for help, you know, a bit of guidance. And you're not talking about a young lady. You're talking about, you know, an elder woman who's the last thing she probably needs in her life is to be, you know, stressed that she's got a son that's in custody for years to come. What a terrible thing for her to have to go through. And it's only now, I guess, you and I, well, look, let's put it in perspective. We didn't have to really worry about our parents back then because it just wasn't something that was a part of our life. Yeah. In hindsight, but those that are lucky enough to have the support still of their mum or their dad or brother, sister, whomever it may be, their loved one, wife, husband, you've created somewhere where they can actually feel, especially this last 12 months with COVID. I don't personally believe been a worse time for anybody to be incarcerated. in any part, especially I can speak of Australia, the amount of lockdowns, the lack of connection with family and loved ones through visits. You and I both know the violence and riots and the anger, you know, Christmas times and those times where, you know, you're just wanting to touch your wife or your mum or your dad or your child and just be held and say, I love you, to get you through the next couple of weeks or, you know, whatever it might be. But it's all gone.
You're right. And it, you know, it looked like it's coming back, and then all of a sudden one person's got it, and then bang, it stops again. And, you know, this plays on emotions. And, look, I just think that I agree with you. I think it's the worst time since I've known about jail, this worst time to be in, because it's unpredictable. You don't know where you're going to be or what you're going to do. And New South Wales particularly, when they move, they're moving people all over the state. You know, and there's people on remand that are temporary bed fillers. I mean, it's an outrageous setup where they could be at Wellington tomorrow and they could be at Nowra the next day. And, you know, and the people, you see yourself, they write, they get in, they message and they say, you know, how do I get a visit? What do I do? They don't even know what number to ring. And they get so much information from this group. And it makes you really feel good when you see them again. And that's what I've said a few times when I was mentioned, that, you know, the admin don't have to do anywhere near as much as we did at the start, because the more people get in there, the more people. And as you said, we've got lawyers, we've got professors there. You know, we've got all sorts. We've got storytellers there. We've got people tell jokes.
And people helping with employment and accommodation, I've seen as well.
Exactly. Yeah, now, and donating clothes and stuff like that.
There's nothing like it, John. Yeah. And we talk about redemption, and why I'm really pushing on this is because, you know, like I said to you in the beginning, and look, you got to take the good with the bad. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I'm not going to give this person too much time, but, you know, there was a comment on our iTunes about glorifying and, you know, how terrible it is and all this sort of stuff. And I thought to myself, I get it. You're entitled to your opinion. I respect that, everybody. But have you listened to the story of whichever episode you're listening to? Because every single story on the Clink has a story of redemption. But we must tell the truth in the story to begin with of why that person has a story of redemption. What you're now doing is amazing, and is with the many others that are involved, is creating a network of support to help people that aren't criminals, that aren't, you know, that aren't a part of the system, that they've been drawn into the system through whatever side it might be, as I said before, a mum, a dad, a brother, a sister, a loved one, but they're just supporting and protecting and trying to care for those that are incarcerated. Now, you know, not everybody's a bad person that goes to jail. Yeah, I imported drugs. You robbed banks. We got fucking pinched. We did the whack. We did wrong. You know, but there's many a men and women out there that have been in a situation or a circumstance that it may have been just to defend their own person from a rape, a protecting of a child or whatever it might be, a totally innocent, when you look at it from that point of view, that have lost many, many years of their lives. So therefore, that just changes the whole dynamics of a family.
It does. And you notice that prisoners and their families and the group acknowledges the families. And look, to me, the wives, the girlfriends, are the unsung heroes. They're the ones you don't hear about. They're the ones that come out every week. They're the ones that bring up the kids. They're the ones that pay the bills, put money in the property of the guy in jail. And they're the ones that battle on and quite often get abused because they're not doing what they supposedly should be doing. The guy's on edge and, he's under pressure and he takes down on the person that he shouldn't be taking out. But, you know, they do it. And, you know, it's happened to me. Gloria was very loyal to me over the years. And I know I've got other friends whose women are very loyal to them.
Well, mine stuck 6 years with me too. And, I always vowed to do was never to get off the phone on a bad note, because just knew that, you know, she had to then do the time with me. Raise the children, listen to my shit, try and deal with my emotions, and, you know, still try and find money for me buy-ups every week, me phone calls. And, mate, Yeah.
The unsung heroes.
Amazing people.
And you've seen the same as I've seen. Guys go off their brain, abuse and smash phones and all that because things aren't working out. And, you know, and we occasionally get a message from some of these women that say that you know, that doesn't matter what they do, they can't do anything right because they're not doing this or that. And so I see it, and it brings it home to me that they are the unsung heroes. And yeah. I say it here on the program, you can see it yourself, that, and you've said
no,
it.
No,
100%. 100%. But look, let's get talking about, and I'll tell you about some of the things I'm doing. I should point out that when I was in jail, when you could do a course, I did writing course in jail. And
Hang on. You what? You're an author?
Well,
are you a writer, John?
No, I was a storyteller. When I was a kid, I kid.
I love that.
They would come outside my house and say, Mrs. Kelly, can Donnie come out and tell us a story? No. And they were bigger than me, mate. I'd come out and I'd get in the middle of it. I'd sit down around and I'd tell them the stories and I'd make it up as I go along. And, you know, I started doing chapters and I was just a natural storyteller. And so I always thought, look, I'm a writer, I'll be a writer. And, you know, I'm a better writer than anybody. You know, I write great books and all that. So when I landed in H Division, I had terrible times down there.
Now, H Division, we're talking about Pentridge in Melbourne, one of the most notorious maximum security prisons of its time.
Right. And, you know, I went down there because a couple of escapes and things. And they bashed people when they got there. That was the same as Grafton. It's notorious. It finished up having riots and there was a Royal Commission into it. And it's well known. H for Hell Division. It was a pretty bad place. But I was down there and I thought, well, look, all this time I'm wasting. And most of the time I was in solitary down breaking rocks. You wouldn't believe breaking rocks in the 20th century, but I was. And I'd walk up and down the yard and I had all these great stories. And I thought, I want to get these stories out. So I put in a writing course. Of course, they kept knocking me back and I kept putting it in. And in the end, I drove them crazy. They said, let him do a writing course.
How long were you serving at this time, John?
I was doing 7 years, finished up doing 8.5 because I got 8.5 months extra. But
was that for the big the attempt at escapade?
Yeah. Well,
we talked about that in season one. That was pretty full.
About that. Yeah. I was in a bank robbing, tried to escape Hawthorne Court, just about made it. Got tackled by a buddy, locally plays AFL, but he tackled me like a rugby league player. I mean, you wouldn't believe the odds of that. And then got involved in a siege and took the prison officer's gun. That was a hell of a thing. And, you know, got a 4 years in H Division for that. And yeah. I was there when they hanged Ronnie Ryan. But the thing is that I try to turn that to in my advantage because it was solitary most of the time. So I did a writing course. And, you know, I wrote this great story and sent it off to the guy. He was a writer. And I said, you know, what do you reckon it is? And he come back, I had a C-, red cross marks through it all. And he just chopped it to pieces. And I realised I couldn't write. I didn't know anything about writing. I was a storyteller, not a writer. And I learnt my craft. And in the end, and things were getting tough for me down in Hastings, and I was nearly ready to chuck it in. And I come in one day after a tough day and get in, pick up there's an assignment there for him, A+. And, you know, you just, boom, an A+. You know, as good as you can get for this story. And after that, I started getting A+. Got out. Got a lot of stories published, articles published, but then got back into trouble 5 or 6 years later. And when I came out of Hastings, mostly in solitary and stuff, came back to Sydney, got extradited back for banks up there. And I hadn't seen a woman, let alone spoke to a woman for 6-7 years. And so I joined a debating class and I was really shy. I got in there and didn't talk much, but turned out I wasn't too bad at debating, so I kept getting picked for the debating thing. And gradually after debates, you know, they hang around. And this is what I mean. The jail system was starting to improve. This was a long day. And got to know this girl who she read one of my stories and she said, look, this is really good. And so when I got out, she introduced me to Don Hogg. He was the editor of Man magazine. He saw some of my stories, just went bang, 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 published 3 in a row, did an interview with me. Then I had Nation Review take me up. Then I was writing chess articles for Nation Review. And it was feeling great. But at the same time, you know, I got married. I was working as a photographer. And the money was very poor. You'd get $50 for a short story and you might have to wait 3 weeks to get paid. And you couldn't live as a writer. And the right. guy who taught me to write, Liam Moody, he said, look, Australia's the worst place in the world to be a writer. We haven't got the population. We don't get the money. And he even drove taxis. And he was one of Australia's best poets. So it came to an end, back to jail, et cetera. And, but I always wanted to write a book. And when I got out this time, I did a few more writing courses, you know, to sharpen up. And actually entered a short story contest at Goulburn. And it was an Australian short story and got second prize in it. But it never got acknowledged by the parole board, never got acknowledged by the authorities. They just, you know, you never got acknowledged for any positive like that. And so when I got out, I still, as soon as they grabbed me an extra diamond to Queensland, as soon as I got back, I got this book here, Gambling for Love, which I wrote.
Right.
And I entered it in, put my life story in, and I entered it in 1973 because I didn't want to cash in on the helicopter. I thought, you know, all I'm known for is a helicopter, and I'm more than that, you know. So I'll write this book. I won't mention the helicopter. And it's a bit of a love story too. And but it tells about hate fishing and bank robberies. And
does it give people a little bit more insight to really the man that I'm talking to, John Killick? And
no, it doesn't.
No,
it shows that that I was a good kid, and then I got into trouble. But there's no redemption in this book.
Okay.
At the end of the book, I walk out in 1973, and I got a chip on my shoulder, mile high. I've been hate fished for 4 years. Went bash, flogged. Everything went wrong. And I ended in 73. That's how I felt. I told the truth. That's how that book was.
Right.
And, but, because I knew I'd do another one. And the next one I did, The Last Escape, was time to bring it out, the whole story. And I did the whole story in this, my life story, and about the helicopter, and also about redemption. And the end of it's about redemption. And it's about evolving. And what I've done is evolved back to the guy that I was. You know, not better, but not worse than the guy I was before I got into trouble, before my mother killed herself and I left home and I got into all the trouble. And
Do you think, John, just along that sort of, I'll call it a storyline because it is your storyline, do you think that if you hadn't have, I guess, walked the path that you walked, that you would still have, and I know it's a sort of a weird question to put out there because we're where we are today because of the path we have walked, but do you feel at any time that you possibly wouldn't have achieved writing any books had you not have had all that time in prison and, you know, had committed the crimes that you committed over the years?
You know, you had the time to do it in there. You had the time. And I always was going to write a book, but I did it in jail. I did the first book, most of it in jail. And although the second book I wrote all of it when I got out, and the third book, all of it when I got out. And I've nearly finished a book now about Russell Manser, which is going to be a great book.
Wow.
But the thing is, when you're out, and, you know, I'm having difficulty getting the time to do the book, and it's taking longer than I thought because, you know yourself, when you get out of jail, it's like stepping from a footpath on an escalator.
Yeah.
You're just moving it 10 times the pace. And these things take up so much time. You get up in the morning, you're going to do something. And then you got to do this, you do that, you do that, and you walk the dog and you do that, and you get up to shop and then you pay the bill and you go and do that. Before you know it, it's 4 p.m.
But that's without any phone calls or something else falling in front of you or, you know, reminding you should have been somewhere else.
That's exactly right. And when you're doing work, as a lot of people have got to work as well, it's really, it's quite an achievement, anyone that works to get out in today's world and be able to write a book as well as work. And so I would say, yeah, that's a possibility that I may not have written. I guess we'll never know. But I would have liked to have thought that if I hadn't have been a gambler and gone to jail, I probably would have been on make something of my life. But, yeah, I'm one of those kids who didn't have a chance. You're probably the same. We grew up on the wrong side of town, in trouble early. We never went to university. We never you know, we just didn't have top jobs. And
well, it was taken from us. We weren't given that opportunity. I think that's the reality.
We weren't given that opportunity. And some of us have got, you know, the ability to be able to done well in certain fields that we just will never get that opportunity. But you've got to accept what is. And I wrote the third book on the inside, and that's just, excuse me, an assortment of stories about different people I met in jail. Most of them, or maybe half of them, notorious and well-known, and some of them aren't well-known. There's some good stories in there, some funny stories in there, and I feel that what I've tried to do with it is show the different types of characters that you'll meet in jail, and then also try and show that you can't get people get an idea about a murder and think, oh, they've got an image of what a murder looks like. You've got some of the murders I've met are the most insignificant people that you would never think of in your life that they were dangerous or could kill somebody. And yet you meet, and then you'll meet, you know, like someone that's supposed to be some real tough guy, you know.
Big Brutus Beefcake sort of character.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just dumb as fuck. I mean, and got no idea. And it might be a standover guy in jail because he's a big tough guy, but you see him outside and he's liable to be standing on the sidewalk with a cup.
The funny thing about that is, John, is that they're just happy being that person because they don't want to do anything different to change that. You know, like you say, you do. There is many a man that will take, like yourself, that take the chance and educate. Look at Bernie Matthews. I mean, another man that could have every right to just say, fuck it, I'm just going to keep rebelling against the system, but used it for his advantage to smarten up his already very intelligent brain. You know, and as have done many other men and women too. Let's not forget about all the women out there that are successful right. off the back of some negative in their life as well. Because, you know, the whole thing about stories of redemption is it's for everybody. Everybody has the opportunity to redeem, you know.
What intrigues me, Brent, is, you know, why people become criminals. And, you know, you can look at it and say, well, environment. And now environment's got a lot to do with it, for sure, there's no doubt. But you'll see people have got everything and had everything in their life, but still some of them become criminals. And you'll see a lot of people who had these terrible environments, they still never commit a crime and they do well in life. So, but you're really behind the eight ball if you come from a bad environment. And you look at the kids growing up out of, say, Bloody Mount Druid, out that area, peer pressure, some of them never even gone to school properly and learned to read or write. You imagine what it's like not being able to read or write. You go to jail and then you got a record. You've never had a job. You're in drugs. You've got peer pressure from your mates and you can't read or write. Where are you going to get a job? What are you going to do? And that's what those people haven't got a great lot of chances. And I look at myself and I mean it, and I've said it in the books, I'm down on myself a bit for the trouble I got into in my early lives because I had the ability, I was able to overcome the disadvantages, went to jail, got out, got stories published, was doing writing, owned a photography company, owned shops. And so I had chances. I'm not like those guys. I did get those opportunities. And it got down to me with gambling. And there's always a reason why people self-destruct. And gambling was the main reason for me because I was a very heavy gambler. Others, it's drugs. Others.
Well, you've never been, let's talk about that. You've never been someone into drugs, have you? It's never been your thing.
No, I've never been into drugs.
Alcohol, yeah, but not...
Yeah, but not a lot of alcohol.
No, I remember in season one you just touched on that, and you know, but your thing was your gambling was your downfall.
Well, then I tell you the story about alcohol, where this one really never drink after this happened. About the girl in a nightdress.
No, please, mate, share it with us.
But they wouldn't put it in my book. They made me take it out. They said because it makes me look too bad. And I said, look, I robbed banks. You know, I've escaped. And you're making me take the story, and it's a true story. And but this is what publishers do. So I took it. I've still got the story there, and I'm thinking of putting it in another book eventually because it's a good story and it's true. And when you've got a good story that's true and there's a bit of funny humor in it, I think it should be published. But they just said no. It makes you look bad. So I'll tell you a story here, and you can judge whether it makes you look bad. It doesn't really matter. This is the story. My father was, he'd reached a stage where he didn't have long to live, they all said. He'd drank all his life and smoked, and he had a lot of things wrong. He was on pills and that, and he wasn't allowed to drink anymore. And he was getting depressed, and I knew he was getting very, very depressed. So I went over one Saturday to see him and said, get your walking stick, we're going out. And he said, I can't go. And I said, yeah, you can. I said, first of all, I went down and got three big hamburgers. And he wasn't allowed to have hamburgers. So he said, eat them. And he ate them. And he said, I'm not supposed to. I said, oh, look, Dad, eat them. He ate the hamburgers. He loved that. We got in the car, got him down there. We drove out to the Coogee Bay Hotel. Now, as soon as we walked into that hotel.
Hang on, can I just, of all hotels to talk about, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For those out there that don't know the Coogee Bay Hotel or its history, the Coogee Bay Hotel, wow, what would you say, John, was like a the place to be for anybody with a bit of colour. And I don't mean racially, but I'm talking like anybody, whether you're a corrupt copper, a bank robber, international drug importer, fuck, whatever it was cool to be seen there, wasn't it? It was the spot.
For sure. And you know, Jerry Page owned it at the time. And
that's right. Gary Page's uncle.
He was, that's right. Well, yeah, I think, it might be cousins, but he...
Sorry, yes, it is. It was. Yeah. The old hand of death.
He was the biggest bookie in Australia, or along with Waterhouse at the time.
And, that's right.
It was just, so many colourful identities were there.
Mm.
But Dad was in his own. When he hadn't had a drink for 12 months, walks into the pub, suddenly he's not crippled anymore, he's not any. He walks up to the bar, and suddenly it's Reg Killick going back 30 years when they used to stand at the bar all day, four and five deep, and, you know, drinks off at six sort of thing. And we swapped stories all day. And I said, let's go and sit down. He wouldn't sit down. He said, only women sit down in pubs. He said, men stand up. And that sort of guy he was. And I drank, and I'm not exaggerating, people don't believe it, I drank 16 Bacardis and Cokes.
And well, I'd believe that. Why wouldn't you believe that? I drink a bottle.
Yeah. So,
that's an easy night.
I wasn't quite sober when we walked out, right? But we were okay until the night air hit us. Now, I had a little blue Volkswagen. So we get in the Volkswagen, and all of a sudden, I'm driving badly, apparently, and he starts screaming at me that... I don't know what I'm doing. Stop, he'll drive. And I said, Dad, you haven't had a license for 5 years. And we're arguing. So I drop him home, and he didn't even want me to help him get upstairs. He's got his walking stick, and he staggers away. And he said, I'll be coming and visit you in the morgue. He's going, like, you're a dead man while you're driving. Well, I drove out of the bridge.
Was he more concerned the fact that you're driving after drinking 16 Bacardis?
Well, I think he was, but he was pretty bad gone himself. But I was going okay. And I'm going over to see my brother over in Newport. And by the time I got round about, where was it? Just near DY.
Yes, I was born there, Manly.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm driving around and I'm lost. And I dead set, I'm really going bad. And I finished going down near Manly somewhere. And I don't know how to get there. And you didn't have mobile phones. And I'm driving around and I'm really, really drunk. And then I see two of these girls hitching a ride. And they're both drunk too. So I pull up and they get in. So where he's going, one gets in the front, one gets in the back. And we're driving along, three drunks in a little blue Beetle on the road to nowhere because I didn't even know where I'm going. And they start telling me that I'm going the wrong way. And so next thing, all I remember... One of them had me around the neck from behind, and the other ones hit me. Now, I honestly didn't do anything except I'd taken a wrong turn and because I didn't really know what I was doing. And I smashed into the back of another car, and it's knocked me out.
Oh, shit.
And the girl on my passenger side dived out and broke her collarbone. And when I've come to, I'm surrounded by people everywhere, and I had a suit on and all that. And I saw the girl, she's sitting on the sidewalk, she's crying. and another girl near her. And I was on parole. And I thought, fuck, you know, I'm in a bit of trouble here. And I got out. And they said, take it easy, mate. You all right? I said, yeah, yeah, I'm okay. They said, it's all right. We've got the police coming and everything will be okay. And I started pretending that I had asthma. So I got asthma. You know, can't breathe. And they said, give him a bit of room. He can't breathe. Well, then I took off, died between them. And yes, when your adrenaline's rushing and you're in danger, you start savouring up a bit.
Yeah.
And they've come after me and they're getting and they're chasing me. And I'm diving over the back fence. So I ripped the suit. I've got blood all over me everywhere.
Oh, shit.
And I thought they're going to coin it. And I ran up a block of steps in a unit. This is a true story. And I just got upstairs and knocked on this unit door. And I saw someone looking for the peep bomb. The door opens, and I swear, it's probably one of the best-looking women I've ever seen in my life, standing there. And she had a see-through nightdress.
Oh, and here's you with a busted-up suit, claret hanging out of your fucking
She said, yes. I got blood going.
Oh,
I said, excuse me. I said, bad men are chasing me. I said, can I come in and ring my brother? And she's staring me up and down. She said, yeah, okay. She let me in. So I get in and I was stuffed and I started a light, lay down on the floor. And she said, when bad men, she said, I could kill. I said, if they get me, they'll kill me. She said, I could kill my boyfriend too. She said, he's a first grade Manly football. And she said, he should have been here two hours ago. And dinner's burnt and all that. And, you know, alarm bells going off in my brain. I thought, first grade Manly football comes
in. I'm in the shitty too.
You know, with his girlfriend, she's got a see-through nightdress on her.
Oh, wow, what a look.
I'm lying on the floor. She said, what do you do for a living?
Like, especially when you got Clara coming out of you. It might have looked like she's laid the boot into you or something that you've come into the door. Oh, dear.
Yeah, imagine if she cried rape.
Okay. That's what I mean. It'd be all over.
Yeah. And she said, what do you do for a living? She said, I said, I'm a photographer. She said, what's that? I said, a studio photographer. She said, oh, I've always wanted to get
Oh, did you offer a free, like, voucher?
And I
was coming. Yeah. Oh, look after you.
And I said, can you ring my brother? Because I want to get out of here, you know. And,
yeah.
She rang my brother, and I passed out. And next thing, my brother's there, and I'm looking around to see if there's any footballers there, but it was, you know, he's not there, and she's got a dressing gown on, and we're leaving, and she passed me a slip of paper, yeah. Now with a phone number on it.
Yeah.
Said, don't forget, give me a call, and she wanted me to do the studio photos. I said, okay, and we get down in. I get in the car, and, you know, you think your brother would say, geez, what happened? John, what's happened? I mean, you know, you're all cut up. You know what he said? Who's the bird? Who's the bird?
I said, no worrying about how his brother looked, but geez, wow, she was nice. It was...
Yeah. And I said, oh, I don't know, I've never met her before. He said, oh, boy. I said, I don't know who she is. So I was getting chased and she let me in. He said, she went away. I said, I'm telling her, I don't know who she is. He said, bullshit. He said, you've got a phone number on the thing. I said, right. And I ripped it up, threw it out. He said, there. And so he drove me home to Gloria, and you think Gloria, you know, would say, oh, my God, is he okay? You know what she said to David? What's he done this time?
Oh, fuck.
So that's the sort of
there stuff. Really was very little concern for your welfare, was there, mate? It's like everybody just expected you to fuck up.
I can't mention a certain guy, but a certain guy said, look, this girl got a broken collarbone, this, that, and blah, and deals were done, and I got out of it. But money changed hands, and that's why they wouldn't put it in the books. Right? But they said it just makes you look bad. I said, look, I robbed banks and escaped and hit a prison officer with an iron bar, and you're telling me this looks bad.
Hey, tell me something, just on that subject, and I'm going to ask you the question, because I think it would be a fair question to ask, especially in your era. Yeah. We hear of the stories around that time when you talk of backhands and corruption. And obviously you don't have to disclose any names, but was there any other times there that, you know, you sort of
See, people look at you and they say, you're reading the newspaper. He's a professional bank robber. He's this, he's that. And they give you an extra, the judge gives you an extra 5 years or something. You're professional, you know. But
so what's class as professional, but the repeat offender?
Well, the guy who runs in and robs a bank and gets away with this well planned. And, you know, you've got getaway routes and this and that. And they have the cops run around, pull their hair out because they don't know who it was.
Okay.
And, you know, so, you know, and you get suspected of doing a lot more than what you do. And, but what people don't understand is you don't start out, or very few do. There might be the rare one that does. Very few start out as professionals. And but what I'm saying, when you start off and you're an amateur, I'll tell you, and this is a true story too. And this guy came to me and he was desperate. And I had never done an armed robbery or any. And he had a bloody a replica pistol, but it fired caps. You know, one of those, it's a starting pistol, you know, and it looked real. And he said, I'm going to knock this railway off. And he said, we're going to get $1,000 out of it. He said, you're going to come along. And I said, I don't really want to do it. I didn't really want to do it. I'd never done an armed robbery. And I was a lot younger than him. And so anyway, he said, look, he talked me into it because I needed some money. So being stupid, we go to do it. Now, where the railway was, he had an old car and it used to keep breaking down. So we're going to do this railway. He parked the car on the top of the hill.
So it rolled down.
No. What? So it didn't start, but if you run behind and pushed it, it started.
That's what I mean. So it rolled down, you could clutch it.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the plan. What? So he had false teeth. So he got his false teeth and put him in the car. Right? And he's running, I'm running behind him, scared the shit out of the poor bloody guy in the railway, and all the money's gone, see? Mm. And he's screaming out about his teeth and he's got this bloody river stocking on his head. He looked like a Martian and he couldn't talk properly. Oh. He said, open the safe. And the bloke said, I can't open the safe. He's going, blah, blah, blah. And the money's gone. And so we run off. Well, we were running away. We didn't get any. The railway guy ran out screaming, stop, stop, thief. And so he wasn't a very good runner. So I ran up ahead of him, got past him. And I got to the car. And he jumped in. No, that's right. Yeah, he jumped in. And he said, push it. So I pushed it. And you look back at the railway guy's coming and it's rolling down the hill, it wouldn't start.
That's like fucking Dumber and Dumber on the fucking world's first robbery.
And the guy's catching up to us. The railway guy's catching up to us. He said, and he jumped out and he left me there and he started running through the park, my mate. So I said, stuff there right after him. Well, we got through the park to it. There's a really big park across virtually half a mile of it and got through there. And he gets there and he starts babbling. I said, where's your teeth?
In the car.
He's left the teeth in the car, see?
Imagine if they'd got his DNA off that today. He'd be fucking back then, it would have been a laugh. It would have been at the front page, you know, robber loses teeth, robbing railway.
Oh, yeah, man. So, you know, I mean,
wow.
So I always remembered stuff like that, and I think, you know, they talk about professional bank robbers. You know, has anyone ever been involved in something that stupid and ridiculous? Right away. And lucky the car wasn't in his name. It wasn't in his name. And the teeth, the cops would have the teeth, but they, I don't know, they would have found the teeth.
Can you imagine all over the front page? Yeah. Hey, railway robbery. Thief leaves behind teeth. Anybody knows any information?
You can imagine.
Walking around with a bloke with a fucking old gum.
But he was walking around, didn't have the money to go to the
dentist. That's what I mean. He'd be fucking standing out like dog's balls.
So, I mean, don't give me that stuff about professional criminals.
Oh, dear.
You know, there were times when I never was, you know, and you just learn the trade as you go along.
Let's just put that back in perspective. That is a funny story where no one was hurt other than a man losing his teeth. All right, so for anybody out there that feels the need to sort of feel that, you know, we're glorifying, there's no glorification in that story. No, it is pure, absolute funny. And John, what a memory.
No, but, you know, he went on never to get in trouble in his life after that.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, for the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good's that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.